Vermeer, Rembrandt, Hals, masterpieces from the Moist House, is on view at the Frick Collection through January 19th. The Frick is the final American venue of a global tour of paintings from the Royal Picture Gallery, Moist House at The Hague, the Netherlands. And the show includes some of the most famous paintings from that collection, works that rarely travel, like Vermeer's iconic Girl with a Pearl Earring. Margaret Nyoko, how do I pronounce your name?
Iacono.
Iacono, okay. Is assistant curator at the Frick, and she joins us now to discuss the show and the enduring influence of the Dutch Old Masters. Welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring is the most famous painting in the show. Can you talk about what makes it so intriguing?
Well, I think, first of all, the fact that it's by Vermeer. People hear Vermeer in the title of an exhibition, and they come because they are so intrigued by his art. The particular painting in question, though, I think is so special for a number of reasons. First of all, I think with all Vermeers, there's always this ambiguity to a work. And when I'm having people come in and talking to them about the painting, I'd like to start off by asking how she strikes them. Does she strike them as a wide-eyed innocent or as a sort of coy temptress who's looking over her shoulders at them? And it's very interesting for me because I get very adamant responses on both sides. People interpret her differently, and I think you can see both aspects to her.
It's a trony, what's called a trony. Can you explain what that means?
A trony is an archaic term very specific to Dutch 17th century portraiture, and really it's a question of intent. When a trony was made by an artist, it was not a commissioned work like a portrait would have been, so there was more creative license on the part of the artist, and it would have been sold on the open market.
So although we assume it's a true likeness, we have no idea just how much Vermeer improvised.
We don't know. It's a head study. Likely there was a live model who actually served as his inspiration, but he may have idealized her very much. Certainly she's an exotic garb, which is typical of a trony.
And he did a few. There are two beautiful ones at the National Gallery in Washington, the Girl in the Red Hat.
That's right.
There's also a girl in a green hat, is it?
Flute player. And the Metropolitan Museum of Art also has another trony, also by Vermeer.
But the Frick has three great Vermeers there in its permanent collection. But unlike Girl with a Pearl Earring, they're all genre scenes, interiors.
Mm-hmm.
Did he mostly do anonymous subjects?
Yeah, I would say yes. As far as we know, we have about 36 paintings that are still in existence that we can attribute to Vermeer. He probably didn't do any more than 60. And from what we have in existence, these do seem to be genre scenes or scenes of everyday subjects primarily. His earlier works were mythologies and religious works. But I think it's this very ambiguous quality that really appeals to us, even in the genre scenes.
And they appealed to the Dutch in the 17th century.
Why
were they so popular at that time?
You know, I think for a few reasons. First of all, Vermeer tended to focus on primarily women and people from the upper echelons of society. So it was a wonderful opportunity to see beautiful clothing, jewelry. I think for the reasons he appeals to us today, his technical mastery.
Well, was he really appreciated all that much during his lifetime?
He was. He wasn't widely known outside of Delft, the city where he was from, but we think he may have had a patron who might have had first right of refusal. Peter van Ralphen is a collector who we think owned about 21 Vermeers. He was a very wealthy man, and it seems that he was Vermeer's primary patron.
Vermeer was actually an art dealer, so was painting his primary source of income, or was it selling other people's work?
Well, we don't know for sure. We know that he certainly did rely on his art dealing as well. In fact, he owned a number of paintings when he died that his wife registered in the inventory of his death records. But we assume that his painting was also important.
Now, when you say he owned other people's work, I'm assuming not a Rembrandt, who was his contemporary.
Not a Rembrandt, but we know that he owned works by Fabricius, and Fabricius's Goldfinch is in our show as well. And we know that there was a correlation between the two.
And I want to talk about that Fabricius painting in a little bit, because right now a lot of people are looking at it for another reason. Donatart has written a novel and borrowed the title.
That's right.
And it's on the cover of the book. It's a part of the story she tells. Vermeer used to be called the Sphinx of the Delft. Was that because he was such a mystery?
Yeah, and it's really because he was rediscovered in the 19th century.
Now, it's hard to understand for someone like me why Vermeer would go out of fashion, or why Caravaggio would go out of fashion, or Piero della Francesca, and a number of other artists mm-hmm. who now strike us as some of the greatest that ever lived. But do we know why?
Well, I think we constantly see in the history of art this evolution of taste, and different styles come in. Rembrandt at one moment is, the talk of a town, and then eventually he's considered a bit outdated, his style of painting. And in an artist like Vermeer, where you have so few works, and he didn't have a very large national presence, I think that's how he gets lost to time.
Wasn't Girl with a Pearl Earring sold in 1881 for a really low price?
Yes, for 2 guilders and a buyer's premium of 30 cents. It's about $7.
So what turned it around? I've been told that mm-hmm. maybe the advent of photography, people started seeing the work through the way he dealt with space as being kind of photographic.
I think that's very possible. In the particular case of the Girl with Pearl Earring, though, we know the painting was very dirty. We know that Vermeer did not have quite the cachet that he does today. In fact, he didn't have anywhere near the cachet he does today. And one of a great art historian, Théophile Touré, actually rediscovers Vermeer and publishes a semi-monograph in the 1860s, and that really raises his level, and buyers and collectors become aware of his wonderful work.
There are a few other genre paintings in the show, like Jan Steen's As the Old Sing, So Pipe the Young.
Yes.
Did he also fall out of favor for a time?
Yes. Jan Steen, I think, for different reasons. He had a larger oeuvre, a body of work. But I think in his case, he's sometimes dismissed because he often has this comic element in his paintings. I think he's sort of seen as a buffoon and dismissed, which is a shame because he's a fabulous artist. And if you come and see the show, you'll see actually 2 examples of his work.
And when you look at them next to Vermeer, you see certain similarities, although Vermeer is the high and he is the low.
High and low. Well, I think I might argue about the high.
No, I don't mean in terms of quality. I mean in terms of the worlds that they're
painting. Absolutely. The classes that they're showing, or, yes, the levels of society, that's true.
There's another painting by Steen on view, The Oyster Eater, which mm-hmm. depicts a young woman putting salt on an oyster, and she's looking out at the viewer. Can you explain how this painting is meant to be suggestive? Were oysters seen as aphrodisiacs? What that's all about?
Yes. Oysters were seen as aphrodisiacs really since ancient times. And like pearls in Dutch art, once you start looking for oysters, you see them everywhere. And the fact that she's salting, possibly peppering, but we think salting the oyster is important too, because salt was also seen as an aphrodisiac. So this is sort of a double whammy.
My guest is Margaret Iacono, assistant curator at the Frick. We're talking about the incredible show that's currently at the Frick, Vermeer, Rembrandt, and Rembrandt Hall's masterpieces from the Marist House, made possible because the Marist House has been going through a renovation?
Yes. They are located in a splendid 17th century Dutch classicist palace. Like the Frick collection, the building that they're in was built as a private residence. And, of course, they've outgrown their space. And so they had to close the museum 2 years ago and take all of the paintings off the wall. And they approached various museums to see if they would be interested in borrowing their works. And, of course, we were.
Well, these paintings don't travel very much. Traveled very much. And I'm assuming now that the building has been renovated and is scheduled to open very soon, isn't it?
Yes, June 27th of 2014. They've just announced that they're on track with their construction.
Well, is there something about the Dutch in museums? Because the Rijksmuseum has been under construction for years and years.
That's true. The Rijksmuseum was planned further back in time. You know, I think it's really just that they continue to acquire, and so they, like any museum, start to lose space. And I think there's also a change in what the public expects in a museum these days. Dining facilities, classrooms for students, gift shops even, and these take space, and that they were not part of the initial design of these buildings.
Is the Maurice House mostly devoted to Dutch paintings?
It's completely devoted to Northern painting. So painting paintings from the 15th to the 18th century and from what is present-day Netherlands and also Belgium. No works of decorative art, so unlike the Frick in that way, and no sculpture, so strictly paintings.
So Flemish and Dutch art.
Flemish and Dutch, exactly.
You mentioned the goldfinch. Didn't its painter Carol Fabricius study with Rembrandt?
Yes.
It doesn't look like a Rembrandt.
It does not look like a Rembrandt, that particular one. He was a student of Rembrandt in the early 1640s. His earlier works do look more like Rembrandt, that warm, dark palette. He tends to do subjects that are more religious in nature, mythologies. But he's really a transitional figure, and he evolves to this more daylight, bright palette. And I think that's really where you start to see similarities and links with Vermeer.
Well, all of this Dutch art is different from what we see in the rest of Europe at that time.
Yes.
Well, there were religious paintings everywhere, but this is a transitionary period where we're seeing all these genre paintings and paintings on subjects like goldfinches that you can't imagine coming out of Italy or France.
Absolutely.
And the reason is the Dutch, usually given, is that the Dutch were so into business, they were so mercantile that they had different concerns than the rest of Europe?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think actually more specifically, they had just at the beginning of the century fought off Catholic Spain. There's a loss in church commissions, and really art evolves to meet the public demands, and no longer do people want to hang religious works in their home. They want scenes of everyday life. They want secular images. So landscapes become popular, and still lives, and these paintings of everyday life.
Great still lives, but
great
also
stills.
Paintings of goldfinches.
Yes.
By the way, we have a slideshow of works from the show on our website at WNYC.org. Rembrandt's Susanna is a history painting.
Mm-hmm.
What story is it telling?
Well, a history painting, as it was called at the time, also includes religious work. So this is really a story from Daniel, the biblical story. It's very telling because it's actually a story that is done very often in the history of art. Susanna, on a daily basis, bathes or swims on her property in a pond. And one day, two elders from the Babylonian community approach her, and they try to seduce her. They call out to her from the bushes and physically attack her, actually. And she is a figure of modesty and virtue, and she rebuffs them. And what's interesting about this painting in particular by Rembrandt is that I think it in so many ways encapsulates what Rembrandt is interested in. He shows the figure of, he gives us pride of place, placing her in the limelight and really banishing these two elders. You can barely make them out. They're on the margins of the painting. And what he does care about is her reaction to this horrible crime.
But she's looking directly out at the
viewer. She's looking at us, yes, for help, it seems. Her eyes are red. Her nose is red. She's been crying.
And it's interesting, as I mentioned earlier, that Rembrandt and Vermeer are contemporaries because their styles are so different.
Absolutely.
Usually there's a kind of a national style.
That's true. I mean, there are some regional styles, I would say, at the time, but there was no one national style at this time. Art is so prolific at this moment. There is so much art being created at this moment that you do have many different styles.
Should we assume most of these paintings were done on commission?
I think the vast majority were done on commission. Certainly we know that portraits were done on commission, but many were also done for the open market. As a matter of fact, I think maybe even more were done for the open market than commission, other than portraits. And because of that, artists had to keep evolving their subject matter to keep up, to really become appealing to what the public wanted.
There are two portraits by Frans Hals in the exhibition of a husband and a wife.
Right.
Do we know who they were?
We do. We know Jacob Olekan was 29. His wife, Aletta, was 19. We know that they were painted a year after their marriage. The paintings are done in 1625. And it's really to commemorate their vows, their nuptials.
Well, at times, Hals looks like he's really improvising, but mm-hmm. these paintings are rather finished.
They're very finished. They're very formal-looking and very unusual-looking, I think, for Hals. And many people are surprised, I think, to find out that they are by Hals. I think that's on purpose, though. There is a philosophy at the time, a theory of tranquillitas, and certain sitters, especially those who held civic positions, chose to be rendered in a less animated, more formal style. And this was really to give a sense of self-evolvement, maturity, values that would have spoken and kind of showcased how mature and in control these particular people were. And I think that had something to do with the effect of these particular works.
The Rijksmuseum has a lot of huge paintings of groups, people who were in guilds and the like. Does the Murray's House have those kinds of paintings as well?
Not nearly as many. You see many more of them. You see some, but you see many more at the Rijksmuseum or, for example, the Frans Hals Museum in Harlem.
Is that because the Murray's House is in the Hague, which is a rather small, although very important, town because it's a major center of European politics?
That's interesting. I think actually it has more to do with the tastes of the stadtholders, the people who were basically the presidents in a sense, or the people of authority who collected the paintings at the time. And really, the core of the collection is based on these private collections of these stadtholders, and it evolves as an example of their personal taste.
There's also a contemporary work on view, a digital painting.
Yes, which is rare for the Frick.
And that is yours or theirs?
It actually belongs to the Moritz House. They haven't taken possession of it yet, but it was a gift from the artists who made it, and you'll be able to see it at the Moritz House when they reopen.
Now, as we said, these works are unlike what's going on in the rest of Europe, although influenced often, like Rembrandt is definitely influenced by Caravaggio.
Yes.
But did the influence go the other way as well?
Absolutely. You have Dutch artists working in Italy earlier in time, and you have Italian artists being influenced by Dutch art as well. Certainly the influence goes different ways. And because there's such an abundance of Dutch art at the time, you do have wealthy collectors from other countries collecting Dutch art even then.
And should we assume that these the best of these painters were also shaping the tastes of collectors?
Absolutely.
Or were the collectors saying, this is the kind of painting I want, and the painters adjusting to that?
I think the collectors were saying that in the sense that they weren't buying religious works, and many artists wanted to be history painters like Rembrandt. And because
Vermeer was a very religious man. And
he was,
I'm assuming he would have preferred to do religious works. But
I think quite possibly his earlier works were religious. It's true.
So he had to adjust.
He had to also do. Yeah, he had to. These genre scenes, these scenes of everyday life, were quite popular. And of course, artists, the whole goal of being an artist is not just to create timeless art. That's a lovely value, but they had to make a living. And Vermeer had 11 children to support, so he needed his works to sell. And the same with Rembrandt. He had to change and become a portraitist, which was lucky for us because he became one of the best ever.
We only have about 3 more weeks to see this show at
the
Frick.
That's
right. Vermeer, Rembrandt, Hals, masterpieces from the Morris House. And by the way, when is the Frick's birthday, the 78th year?
We've just celebrated our birthday recently, yes, as a
Happy
museum,
birthday.
78 years. Thank you.
Margaret Iacono is assistant curator at the Frick. The show is called Vermeer, Rembrandt, Hals, masterpieces from the Murray's House, and there's a gorgeous catalog called Girl with a Pearl Earring, Dutch Paintings from the Murray's House, that is published by Delmonico Prestel. You can also see a slideshow on our website at wnyc.org.